We are not alone in the universe. Sounds like the beginning of a science fiction novel, doesn't it? In this case, it is a statement of fact. The Bible presents itself as a supernatural book, which from Genesis to Revelation makes the case that mankind occupies space and time, but is certainly not alone, dimensionally speaking. The truth is, mankind is primed to embark on a revised reality which promises to turn everything we thought we knew on its head. Stay tuned for my conversation with publisher, author, and researcher Doug Woodward on this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. I'm excited to announce a new partnership with Global Star Radio Network, where SER is heard every Saturday evening at 7. You can listen on that platform via www.gsradio.net. We're also heard on WTTP-FM, Saturday evenings at 11 and Sunday evenings at 9. You can listen to us on their website, www.wttpfm.com. And of course, all the usual social media platforms and on our website, soaringeagleradio.com. My guest today is Doug Woodward. He is the noted author of several books, including Lying Wonders of the Red Planet, Uncommon Sense, The Next Great War in the Middle East, and a co-author of Revising Reality, A Biblical Look into the Cosmos, which is the subject of our conversation today. Doug, welcome back to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Hey, Mike, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me once again. Basic, fundamental thesis of the book is that as Christians, we've allowed ourselves to be brainwashed more or less by media and by academics and so forth, so that we've absorbed the secular, to some extent, atheistic point of view. And there really is a need for us to sort of cleanse our minds and refresh our minds and revise our reality as we understand it. So it begins with that, but the phrase revising reality really has many meanings, and we'll talk about a few of those as we progress through this discussion.
Yeah, and I don't think you could have taken a bigger bite out of the apple than to take on the subject of completely changing the way we look at, well, almost everything. So, first question out of the gate, Doug, is where did you come up with the idea to undertake such a monumental task as this?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I have a perfect answer for that. I suppose that in part my sense in terms of how I approach my faith, it tends to be probably overly intellectual. I studied kind of philosophy of religion when I was in college, and I wrote several books back then that were never published. Back then, we couldn't get books published unless you were sort of already had, you know, a relationship with a publisher, right, and were known, you know, some way. Yeah. Today it's a lot different, of course. Yeah. But I've always thought about issues more intellectually and theologically, and it just occurred to me, really, that in the last few years we've had such a radical transformation of our thinking because of the discussions about the giants and the Nephilim, and then more recently Michael Heiser, who's done, you know, some terrific work in his book The Unseen Realm, really getting us to think again about what is meant by the, you know, the divine host, the heavenly host, and so on. And it occurred to me that what we were missing is that we haven't attempted, those of us in sort of this prophetic community that interact with each other, and you know, I don't know how big our community is. Maybe it's half a million people. Maybe it's more. Certainly the community of writers, authors, and so forth is well, you know, probably not more than 50 of us. But nevertheless, we really haven't attempted to sort of compare and contrast our view of the cosmos with the view of the cosmos that's articulated by the secular cosmologist. I started to say cosmetologist, which would be blowing one of my early jokes, but there are a couple of cosmologists that are pretty popular and on TV a lot today, Michio Kaku and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah. Both of them are pretty popular. Stephen Hawking, the gentleman that has ALS, been bound to a wheelchair for decades, is probably the most well-known cosmologist, although most people today probably don't know that he is a cosmologist as well as a physicist. And but, you know, we haven't really attempted to explain what our view of the cosmos is as it relates to kind of the view that's espoused by academia. So I felt like it was time to do that, and I felt like that I had some good relationships with these three co-authors and that we could work together, and I probably would do the lion's share of the editing and the heavy lifting, but I'd get great input from all three, which is exactly what happened, and we were able to bring together a book that has some coherence, despite the fact there were four of us working on it.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly, Doug. I think it's a great book. It flows well, and I particularly appreciate your comments about trying to bring to light newly revealed evidence, new research. Some of this has been around for a while in the small group of writers, authors, and speakers that you mentioned. But this book really just lays it all out there. A lot of the things that very few Christians are aware of. And I like the way that you started the book, Doug, because you laid it out that the cosmos belongs to God. He is the creator, and all of the cosmos speaks about him as the creator. And I thought that was a wonderful Indeed. Way to start it.
Yes, absolutely. And really, the book deals with a couple of the most seminal issues. One is the Christology. You know, what does the meaning of the Christ event, as theologians would call it, yeah, you know, the manifestation, the incarnation, what does that tell us about the cosmos? And, you know, and then beyond that, really looking at going back to the very beginning of the scripture of the Bible in Genesis chapter 1, there are a number of course, critical verses there that really lay the foundation for our, I'll call it peculiar because it really is a unique understanding of the cosmos. And we should talk about some of those things. And cosmos, just to clarify, is a definition that basically means that the creation is structured, ordered, that it's teleological, that is, that it has a design, mm-hmm, and if it has a design, then it has a designer.
Yes.
And it stands in contrast to sort of the Greek idea of the creation, which was a creation fashioned from the chaos.
Yes.
And so cosmos is sort of the opposite of chaos.
Yeah, yeah. Doug, you and Josh charge out of the gate in chapter 1 discussing the Nephilim. And I thought, I don't think I could have picked a better subject to start chapter 1 to get people's attention than the Nephilim. So talk about, you know, grabbing the bull by the horns immediately just to let them know, hey, this isn't going to be your run-of-the-mill book. We're actually to discuss some
That's
things
right.
that need to be discussed. So now...
Well, Exactly. Yeah, go ahead. Go
well,
ahead.
Just having said that, I do want to say that few, if any of our listeners are not familiar with the biblical record of the Nephilim, but for the sake of the one or two who might be listening and they have no idea what the Nephilim are, I'm wondering if you'd give an overview of that and why that's important for us to understand today.
Sure. Well, as we start the book off by talking about the fact that over the past few years that the kind of some of the key themes of eschatology, of Bible prophecy, have been influenced heavily by the work of Steve Quayle, Elie Marzulli, and a number of others, Michael Heiser, certainly I mentioned earlier, in terms of talking about Genesis chapters 1 through 6, and then some of the apocryphal, non-biblical, non-canonical sources, like the book of Enoch and the book of Jasher and so on. And the idea of starting with the Nephilim, it was very intentional, and it was the starting point because that has been kind of such a dominating subject. And it really refers to Genesis chapter 6, talking about the sons of God that came into the daughters of men and with them begat offspring that were called the Nephilim, the mighty ones. Nephilim really means fallen ones, and oftentimes it's misunderstood to mean fallen angels. Right. It really doesn't refer to the fallen angels. It refers to the offspring of the fallen angels. In effect, when we say daughters of men, that's really a biblical way of saying that we're fully human. The fully human women had interbred in some manner with angelic beings. And right there, it's kind of the shock treatment to say, now, if you buy into that, our understanding of cosmology is radically different than virtually anyone else in the whole religious scene, that angelic beings and women would be able to create offspring. Now, having said that, that's true certainly in the modern day, but looking back historically at various cults and old religions and mystery religions and all that, they all had accounts of especially the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians of gods and humans mating and creating the Titans. Even Moses in chapter 6 says these were the men of renown, which really was a biblical way of saying this was the origin of the stories about the Olympians and the Titans and so on, and that's where it all began when these angels came and somehow intermingled their seed with the seed of human beings.
Yes, yeah. And I appreciate the fact, Doug, that you took the time to provide some theories as to how the giants appeared after the flood, because that's a question that has really puzzled people for a long time, isn't it?
It is. It's probably one of the most controversial subjects amongst those of us that are open and subscribe to this point of view that there was an intermingling of angelic and human, we'll just come right out and say it, angelic and human DNA, that somehow they were commingled.
Yeah.
And as shocking as that sounds, and that it was really that event that has absolutely, and this is what's so controversial, is that it's foundational to understanding the whole doctrine of salvation, the doctrine of Christology and everything, that if you don't get that, if you don't understand the proper biblical meaning of Genesis chapter 6, you really end up with a variant of what the Bible teaches is the reason that God became man, and so much of the reason for why things happened in the Old Testament, specifically the conquering of Canaan and so forth with Joshua, and why were certain peoples utterly destroyed and other peoples not.
Yes.
If you don't understand the concept of the Nephilim, you'll never get there. And so, yeah, so we talk about the different theories, and we could probably spend the whole show just talking about these different theories.
That's right.
About how the Nephilim appear again after the flood, because the assumption, the premise that we believe the Bible is asserting, and it's confirmed by lots of extra-biblical sources, is that the flood was primarily an event to destroy the chimeras, the hybrids, if you will, of angels and humans, as well as the fact that, for some reason, the angels were also, the fallen angels were tampering with the animal kingdom and were creating hybrids amongst the animals. Yes. And so the idea was that God preserved the original creation, the original species and so forth on the ark, and everything else was destroyed. Yeah. Now, was everything else destroyed, or were there certain giants that persisted afterward, or did the same what's called the incursion of the angels, was there a second incursion and a multiple incursions after the flood? And the whole, you know, getting into the whole story of Atlantis and theories of lost civilizations and so forth, it is a rabbit hole that has been fun to explore myself over the last 5-6 years. Yes. And for many of your listeners, I know that they can relate to the intrigue that it holds for us.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I'm puzzled by, Doug, is that the, if I can describe them this way, but mainline scholarship, our philosophers, our Bible scholars in the seminaries, when they're especially apologetically speaking, when they're making an argument for or against atheism that says, well, the God that you portray in the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, is equivalent to a moral monster, and I look at this perspective, this understanding of why God would say that you know, the Amorites, the Amalekites, they need to be wiped out completely and totally, and nothing survive. When we understand this perspective, the Old Testament really makes a lot more sense, doesn't it?
It does, and it's not that God said to Moses, and then later just to Joshua and Caleb and others, that they should wipe out every, say humanoid, every humanoid in Canaan. Because it was very specific. It was primarily tribes that lived near where in the, what became later the territory of Dan, or near the mountains in northern Israel. Today we call them the Golan Heights. But Mount Hermon specifically is really kind of the, in Ghostbusters, they called it Spook Central. It's like Mount Hermon. It's sort of like Spook Central, where this craziness happened, where the angels descended. The Book of Enoch says that specifically. 200 of the Watchers, as they were called, descended and upon Mount Hermon, and so yeah, it is a fascinating story, and it leads to lots of things. I've even in the book I wrote on Mars, Lying Wonders of the Red Planet, I go in and explore the whole notion of, you know, these fallen angels, and where did they fall from, and were they on another planet, and were they on Mars, and or are they on the planet that was destroyed, that seems to be referenced as Rahab in the Old Testament? So it leads to some admitted speculation, but still grounded to some extent on biblical principles.
Yes, yeah. Before we leave this subject, Doug, I'd like to just touch on this briefly. In concluding your chapter on the Nephilim, you have a heading, and on my copy of the book, it's on page 68, and it says, or it asks this question: will hybrid beings appear again in our day? And you make a very strong argument that the human race is really being prepped for such a thing.
Oh man, yeah, I can say there aren't there just an amazing number of controversial subjects in this very first chapter.
Yes,
and then you still got about 11 more chapters to go.
Right. which the answer, just I'll give the listeners a heads up, Doug. We're not going to be chatting for 5 hours. So we're not going to get through the whole book.
No, we're not. We could take the whole hour just on this first chapter without any question. But there's there are lots of discussions about this, and certainly, if someone allows themselves to go searching out on YouTube, the whole discussion of the hybrids and, you know, the issue of extraterrestrials and the explanation from a biblical standpoint as to what the extraterrestrials might be, alien abduction, you know, all these things, get right back to this this sort of same subject is are there, will there be hybrid beings in the last days? Do they already exist? Do they already walk among us? Yeah. And you would be surprised, well, you wouldn't be, but probably many of your listeners would be surprised to learn that there are some very reputable, we'll call them down-to-earth, both feet planted firmly on the ground, scholars, teachers, and writers that say, yes, hybrids do exist. They're already among us, and that they figure in very, very much to the last days. And the usual sort of biblical connection is talking about as in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming Son of Man. And usually what's referenced or what is interpreted there is that as in the days of Noah, in terms of the Chimera, the hybrid, the Nephilim, we will see them reappear. Certainly, Steve Quayle, L.A. Marzulli, and others have really made that a very, almost a cornerstone of their ministries.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Doug, you and Gans write about the divine council, and this is where you start revising the reality of a much larger segment of Christians, as I thought about that. But I have to say this. I was very blessed recently. I've been teaching through the Book of Psalms on Sunday morning, and my last Sunday in the pulpit a couple of weeks ago, I taught Psalm 82, which you know is a significant psalm having to do with the divine council. And I spoke about Yahweh's counsel, and people actually thanked me afterwards for broaching the subject. Now, I talk about this kind of stuff all the time, mostly just in passing, and I don't do a lot of concentrated teaching on Sunday morning on it. But this particular Sunday I did because we were in Psalm 82, and so the whole message was devoted to the divine counsel. So let's talk about that. Let's discuss what the divine council is and what part that plays in a better understanding of the Bible and certainly our end times events.
Right, right. Well, right up front, we have to acknowledge the great work done by Dr. Michael Heiser. I mentioned the book, The Unseen Realm. He has another book coming out, if not already out. I think it's just about ready to come out, dealing with Mount Hermon and so forth on all these topics. But, you know, Heiser did just a magnificent job of really bringing together not only biblical texts, but a lot of other ancient texts from the area, from that region, that predate, in many cases, the biblical accounts. I guess it's pronounced Ugaritic, which is sort of the old Syrians, the Sumerians, and so forth, that predated the Babylonians. And that the stories of the Middle East dating back 2,000, 3,000 years ago speak to this issue of concept of divine beings that came to Earth, and in many cases, divine beings that were as a council at working together to administer what was happening on planet Earth. And so the issue, of course, in Psalm 82, Psalm 89, and some of the references in 2 Kings and so forth is that we're confronted, you know, if we take the Bible seriously and we believe that the Scripture is inspired and that it actually teaches truth, especially about the nature of God and the heavenly kingdom and the kingdom of God and so forth, we're confronted with the reality that there's this thing called the heavenly host, the divine council, the host of heaven. In some cases, it seems to be referring to stars, and in some cases, it seems to be referring to angels, and then in other cases, it seems to be referring to rulers. The New Testament calls them powers and principalities, which it's really a distinguishment of the rankings of different levels of personages. And of course, that was kind of the reason that we started the book off with the Nephilim, is saying that the fundamental nature of reality is personal. It's a personal God at the top, a personal divine council, personal angels, personal human beings. Yes. It's flooded with, richly endowed with personages. And that unlike the New Age movement or modern theology or Eastern religions, we're not dealing with forces as much as we're dealing with persons. And so, you know, the challenge with the concept of the divine counsel is that it, when you listen to Heiser for the first time or you read the book, The Unseen Realm, you sort of come out of that thinking like, well, is he talking about polytheism?
Right.
Is he saying that there are multiple gods? Mm-hmm. And he's pretty quick to say, no, I'm not saying that there are multiple gods. There is only one real, you know, sort of big capital E Elohim,
yes.
Elohim, but there are many little gods known as the little E Elohim. And in fact, it appears that Jesus himself had a little bit of fun with the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
Yes.
when he was talking to them, mm-hmm. about, yeah. you know, they were saying to him, you know, you sort of claim that you're a god. And he says, well, doesn't the scripture say ye are gods?
Yes. Yes.
Well, and of course, Jesus himself was playing a little bit fast and loose with what was being said in Psalm 2, and in Psalm, you know, in reference in Psalm 82,
mm-hmm.
Because the scripture really is saying that the divine counsel are these little e Elohim,
yes.
that for whatever reason God has chosen to work through persons, and they're not divine at the same level that he is, but in terms of humanity, we would regard them as divine. We would regard them as gods or demigods,
yes.
And so that's really what the teaching is all about. That God has chosen to work through, administrate His governance through a divine council. And we learn in reference to the time of the Tower of Babel and then afterwards that the Lord divided up the nations into 70. Nations in accordance to the number of the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And some, Heiser points out that some have translated that in accordance to the sons of Israel. But the problem is that Israel wasn't going to be founded for another 500 years.
That's right.
So it wasn't Israel he was talking about.
Yeah.
And so according to the number of the sons of God is another phrase that's used, for instance, in Job for the angels. When all the sons of God came before God, and
yes.
God asked them where they'd been, and so on. Sons of God is a reference to any person that is directly created by God himself. And humanity and Adam is a son of God. Jesus is a son of God in a very unique way, as the second person, fully God, and yet he is a son of God, and Lucifer is a son of God. And all the angels are sons of God. And by that, we suppose that it means that all of these beings, all of these persons have, to some extent, free will. They have yes. consciousness. They're sentient beings. And yet, there is a gap of mammoth proportions between the God Yahweh, as he is known in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the rest of the creation, including the angels, the sons of God, the powers and principalities,
yes.
which Christ created. And Paul tells us in Colossians that these beings, while they're powerful, Christ created them, and then ultimately they will all be subdued and brought to be, in effect, like the kings of the earth, enemies that shall be as his footstool beneath his feet.
Yes, yes. When I first came across Dr. Heiser's work and began to look at it myself, one of the things that helped me to grasp and understand, well, actually there were two things, and the first one is that as Western Christians, we have attached, wrongly, I might add, we have attached an understanding of attributes and characteristics to the word Elohim. And when we hear that word, we think of Big G God and all he is, his traits, whether they're communicable or incommunicable traits, we think of Yahweh. And the truth of the matter is that the scriptures, the Old Testament, uses Elohim in the sense of a place of residence. Elohim denotes a supernatural being, and Heiser was one who said, I believe he said it something like this, and of course others have followed suit, but there are many Elohim, but there is only one Elohim that is Yahweh.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that it's interesting just doing a study of the names of God in the Old Testament, because far from there being, you know, just this one name, and a lot of the more illiterate among us would just assume that there's only one name and it's God, and that's the way it's used throughout the Old Testament. But of course, you've been trained theologically, and yes, many of your listeners, of course, understand that there are many names of God. The most ancient of names was El.
Yes.
And of course, there's so many Els, like Daniel in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it's not coincidental that the name of Superman was Ka-El, and so forth.
That's right.
Yeah. Schumacher, when they were developing Superman, they were sort of playing on this concept of El, uh-huh, as a God. But you have Adonai, you have El Shaddai, yes, and of course, ultimately, you have Yahweh in Exodus. What is it? 3:14. Yes. I am that I am, and there is no one else beside me. And Jesus, of course, and I believe it's in chapter 8 or chapter 10, denotes himself as the great I am, and so that is a claim to being Yahweh. And the Jews to whom he was speaking, they had no misunderstanding about what he just said.
That's right.
That's why they immediately picked up rocks to throw at him, to stone him, because he claimed to be Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a good Jew that believed in the transcendence of God, there was nothing worse than to claim that you as a human being, a little human worm, could possibly be equal to, or could be, in effect, the manifestation of Yahweh.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And Doug was referring earlier to, I believe it's John 10, where Jesus had that conversation with the Jews, and they were going to stone him for claiming to be God. And that's when he had a little fun with them, I think, and poked at him a little more. I'll let our listeners read that on their own time.
Right.
Doug Anthony Patch, fabulous scholar, writes about the electric universe. In his chapters, he talks about Einstein, he talks about Tesla, and he really upsets the apple cart by tying CERN into what is termed in the book as our occulted physics. Now, I have to say that those two chapters alone, folks, if you're not convinced yet to go by the book, then I've got to tell you, these two chapters that Anthony Patch and Doug wrote together on the electric universe and CERN, certainly worth the price of the book alone. So let's discuss the most powerful force in the universe, which is electricity.
Yes,
of course. Somebody thought I was going to say gravity.
I know. I was going to, he's going to say gravity, and I'm going to have to go correct him. You realize that electromagnetism is 10 to the 39th power more powerful than gravity?
Yes, that's right. That was a stunner. I had to read that twice when I read it the first time. I was like,
yeah,
wow,
yeah,
10 to the 39th?
Exactly. Yeah, that's so many times that's more particles than exist in the entire universe.
Yeah.
In terms of order of magnitude, so Anthony is has been a terrific find for me.
Oh my goodness.
To stumble across him about a year and a half ago and mm-hmm. begin to listen to him, and happily the Lord blessed me by allowing us to work together to develop what is I think a core part of the book. And in fact, just so your listeners know, by the time they listen to this, we hope to have available at Amazon a DVD specifically on these two chapters.
Oh, perfect.
Entitled CERN Decoded.
Oh, boy.
Is a two-hour detailed interview where I'm basically asking Anthony questions, mm-hmm. and I make a few comments my own. I tend to gravitate towards, that's a bad time to use that word. I tend to list towards towards theology, and Anthony a bit more towards physics.
Yes.
So
perfect.
We try to bring these two things together, right?
Perfect.
The DVD is called CERN Decoded, and it'll be available at Amazon. It's in manufacturing right now, and so I think it'll be it'll be pretty stunning for folks. But yeah, it's those two chapters certainly, are some of the, for some people, perhaps the most outrageous chapters in the book. Because we get this amazing thing that until I'd gotten to know Anthony, I didn't know anything about. But the electric universe, you know, another thing I would just bring up, Mike, that's kind of interesting is once, you know, I was involved in writing this book, I started going back and looking at some of Chuck Missler's materials.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, you know, Chuck was really the guy that was doing a lot of the groundbreaking on these kinds of issues, you know, gosh, over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's written a number of smaller books or had them published on such subjects as, you know, ultra dimensions and so forth. But he did there's 5, 6, 7 years old, a talk on the electric universe, not quite entitled that, but it's really focused on that. And basically, you know, sanctions that whole discussion as far as he's concerned. And the notion of the electric universe in simple terms is the idea that electromagnetism and not gravity is the core force that holds the universe together, notwithstanding the fact that Colossians tells us that Christ himself, you know, is what, all of the universe coheres through Christ. And so somehow there's a relationship between electromagnetism and Christ.
It is electromagnetism.
Yeah, there would be a dissertation, wouldn't there? getting close to God can be a very electric experience, you know, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
So, may you be electrocuted with the Holy Spirit, right? So we talk about work done by a group of scientists, physicists and archaeologists and others, cosmologists really, called the Thunderbolts Project. And their school of thought is known as the electric universe. And one can find, if you go out to YouTube and you just do the electric universe, you're going to find all kinds of movies and videos and almost weekly they continue to come up with maybe a short or maybe a long talk to clarify various things. But, you know, it's things that you don't usually think of. For instance, the sun is not a gigantic hydrogen furnace. It's actually a gigantic electric dynamo. It's a big battery in space. Mm-hmm. And they go through and they explain, based upon the actual physics of the way the sun works, why it is that the sun at the surface and in its atmosphere is many millions of degrees hot, but at its core we discover that it's only about 6,000 degrees Kelvin. Well, if it's a nuclear furnace, the way that science has taught us for the last, 100 years, it wouldn't be that way. It would be many millions of degrees at its core, but it's not. It's relatively cool at its core. And so it tells us that the reason that there's so much heat at the surface of the sun is because there's a massive amount of friction. The sun is drawing particles into it at the same time that it's spewing particles out, known as the solar winds. And so it creates massive amounts of heat because of the friction that's going on. And so, these are concepts that are very scientific, and yet they are so radically different than what we have been taught. And so the electric universe, from a science standpoint, is a core element of what we mean when we say revising reality, because we really believe that if one understands the science, which could be sort of summarized as Nikola Tesla versus Albert Einstein, if one understands that Tesla had the better model for the universe rather than Einstein, we begin to understand that there really is a radical difference from what we were taught with what is beginning to come into focus now, Tesla becoming a really big subject. But anyway, this issue of the electric universe is the scientific basis for revising reality.
Yeah, perfect. And just a thought, I imagine some of our listeners if you could recommend a resource for folks to do some research, studying perhaps a book or a website or something on Tesla, do you have something just off the cuff, Doug, that you might be able to direct our listeners to?
Well, there's a very short biography of Tesla that I found fascinating. It's only about 100 pages, and I'd have to look up the name. So maybe what we could do in the notes of your program or whatever, we could mention that.
Okay.
There probably are a couple of books that we could direct people to, but certainly just doing some searching on YouTube, looking under Nikola Tesla, getting a little bit of a backgrounder on him and kind of what he was about in terms of his science and so on. There's a lot out there right now because he's become very popular because he basically believed in that we could have wireless electricity, believed in anti-gravity flying machines and other things that have been more or less proven to be true. We don't want to get too far afield and talk about the fact that most UFOs really are man-made flying machines. But if you understand Tesla and you talk to Stan Deo sometime, you'll understand that Tesla probably the man in terms of understanding the way physics really works.
Yeah. Now, I imagine some of our listeners are thinking, now, come on, Doug, you can't leave us hanging like that. But yes, we are. We're going to move on.
That's right.
That's all right.
Get the book. You didn't mention that Stan Deo wrote the foreword.
And he
talks about his experiences and how he got recruited into the secret space program because he was already working as a teenager on an anti-grav machine, and the guys, and the guy that was the father of the hydrogen bomb found out about it, and they recruited him to go work in a deep underground military base in the center of Australia for the Illuminati. Okay, that's just the forward to the book,
folks.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Just the forward. Well, we cannot not talk about CERN, so we need to address that. Anthony and you did a great job on that, I thought, and really cutting to the quick on what CERN is and what they're up to there. And this,
right?
I think this might surprise some people, even though there's a lot of conversation, a lot of YouTube material out there on CERN. You've been talking about it forever. So is Anthony Patch. So is Gons, Josh. Everybody that I listen to and read has been talking about it. But I have a sneaky suspicion, Doug, that a lot of folks in the churches, believers, don't really know much about CERN. So let's give them a little something to go on.
Sure. Well, CERN is the particle collider, the Large Hadron Collider, that's just outside of Geneva, Switzerland. It's 27 kilometers in circumference. That's about 17 miles for us non-metric fans. And it lies roughly, I think it's about 100 meters, beneath the surface. So it's underneath the ground. And it really is actually about four particle accelerators. And, the accelerators, what they do is they use a series of magnets. The magnets, circumnavigate this big, big circle. And it speeds up particles. And originally, the particles were just photons, but now they're actually lead ions. And originally, they were colliding these particles sort of at an angle, and now they're colliding them head on. Mm-hmm. And the particle accelerator is its cover story, and we believe it is a cover story, is that they're investigating the nature of the universe in its first sort of 10 microseconds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why would many nations come together to spend billions of dollars to discover how the universe was formed in its first 1 second of existence?
Yes,
of course, that's if you believe the Big Bang and if you believe that that's the origin of the universe. But nevertheless, that's the story. And of course, that's what they're trying to look at, these subatomic particles, oftentimes known as bosons or as quarks. And we kind of bridge from this story of CERN and the particle acceleration, and the powers, the unbelievable powers that are generated from these collisions, into what might really be the purpose of CERN. That's where I did some additional research on various cults and sort of religions that probably are behind some of the founding members and founding fathers of the CERN lab.
Yeah.
But CERN, just to define it, it's a French, it's an acronym based upon the French, but if we were to translate it into English, it would be essentially the, you know, the Center for European Nuclear Research. All right. But in French, it actually lines up to make an acronym. But essentially it was, the ground was broken in 1954. That was the year yours truly was born. And the ground was broken long ago, and it was really in the intention of Europe to do research on the nuclear bomb, because goodness knows Europe did not want just the United States and the Soviets and then kind of maybe England to have access to nuclear technology, and so they decided they needed to have access to nuclear technology themselves. And so that's kind of how CERN got its start, but it became most famous in the last few years with the discovery of the so-called God particle, which is the Higgs boson particle. And I'm not a physicist. I'm really not qualified to talk much about it. I can just kind of tell you what I've learned. And what I've learned is the Higgs boson particle supposedly is the particle that gives mass to all the other particles in the universe. So, you know, that stretches my mind. I'm not sure I know how to explain that. But nevertheless, without the Higgs boson, there apparently the universe, all the particles would have no mass. So that, I guess that means that they couldn't be Catholic.
Right.
Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. But nevertheless, so we get into the amazing powers that are generated. We get into some of the other background. We bring up some of the discussions with the Joseph P. Farrell has talked a bit about in terms of the likelihood that the, based upon the magnitude of the investment, that you're really probably dealing here with some kind of exotic space-oriented technology that might have something to do with what Ronald Reagan was doing back in the 1980s with Star Wars, being able to shoot down aliens, and then we really do some interesting connections to the Tower of Babel. We talk about the fact that CERN is the largest machine that humankind has ever built until you go back to the Tower of Babel. And then we sort of raise the question, what was the Tower of Babel, really? Mm-hmm. And Anthony makes this astounding claim. You know, he basically says, well, if you look at the book of Jasher and you really understand, you know, from some other extra-biblical sources what it was that Nimrod was trying to do, he was actually trying to create a weapon to kill God. And that kind of startles you. Well, sure now, does. How can anybody be so stupid to think that they could kill God? He must be a Nimrod. Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, that's one of the greatest lost in translation names of all time, is that Nimrod actually was regarded as perhaps the king of the earth at one time in the post-diluvian, after the flood age. And but Anthony basically makes the argument that CERN is, in effect, humankind coming together once again to create a weapon system that can do a couple of things. One, it can actually be pointed to Jesus Christ when he comes riding back with his saints as a means to attack the would-be liberator of planet Earth from the demons and the kings of the earth. Mm-hmm. That's one idea. The second idea, which is really pretty stunning, but there's some reasons to suggest this, is that CERN is built on top of what might be the bottomless pit, the abyss. Mm. CERN might be the key to the bottomless pit. CERN might actually be trying to create what's known as a Birkeland current, a highly powerful, intertwined current from the location of CERN to the southern pole of Saturn, mm-hmm. in order to tap into, and this is not necessarily something that I believe or necessarily something that Anthony believes, but it is apparently something that mystery religions and the cults believe, and perhaps even some of the founders of CERN, they believe that there is a black cube mm-hmm. inside of Saturn, and that inside the black cube is held captive seven ancient titans, and that these titans will be brought back to Earth by the Birkeland current from CERN, and it will be CERN that opens the key to the bottomless pit.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, that just seems outrageous.
Yeah.
Well, I would encourage your listeners to go out and do a search. Do a search on Google mm-hmm. and type in the black cube. Mm-hmm. And then look at images.
Yeah.
And look at the hundreds of images associated with the black cube and how the black cube seems to tie into all kinds of ancient religions.
Yeah.
And you got to ask yourself, well, why is the world so amazed about the black cube? What is it about the black cube that is at the basis of many religions? And, you know, just to bring this a little bit more home for folks, you know, most of us not being Muslims, we don't realize what the Muslims do when they do their pilgrimage, their Hajj to Mecca.
Yeah.
They go to Mecca, and they inside this, you know, this temple where it's a giant kind of open-air temple, they all walk around this giant black cube known as the Kaaba.
Yes.
Well, the Kaaba is, it contains a stone, a black stone that they believe is a black meteorite,
mm-hmm.
You know, from some ancient planet, some far, far away, in a universe far, far away, or galaxy far, far away. And this cube is like something like 45 feet square, you know, so it's tall and it's a perfect cube. And they walk around it in rings, in concentric rings. And those rings happen to be in the same direction as the rings circulate around the planet Saturn.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
so I asked you, what is it that they know that maybe they really don't know and that we should know about the black cube Saturn? So that's just, you know, yet another teaser for what we discuss in
yes.
the book.
Yes, that's right. It's a fascinating discussion for sure. Doug, let's use this chapter to take us on out of this episode. You authored a chapter titled, Was Einstein Wrong? The Emerging Cosmology, Physics, Alchemy, and the New Reality. And in that chapter, you discuss the now, in my view, undeniable truth that scientific naturalism is not capable of explaining mystery or the rise of mysticism that we're witnessing today. There is a new awareness among the masses that the divide science has attempted to maintain between the natural and the supernatural world is really not so distinct after all. So let's discuss
right.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's certainly for some time, probably 40, 50 years, there's been quite a bit of discussion about the fact that the new physics, which is now becoming kind of the old physics, was kind of bridging the gap between spirituality and physics. There were a couple of books, The Tao of Physics, what was it, The Dance of the Wu Ling Masters or something like that, that were written back in the 70s, became kind of, you know, key books for the New Age movement when it was getting kicked off back in that time. Marilyn Ferguson and, you know, others that were bringing sort of updating the teachings of Alice Bailey and
yeah.
Madame Helena Blavatsky and all that. And so all this stuff is kind of connected, but there, the, you know, the physics view that was kind of coming together was that there really isn't a distinction between spirituality and physicality. And so it kind of began to sound like, you might say, Christian Science or, you know, Hegel's philosophy or, you know, whatever. So there's sort of a lot of different threads in Western as well as in Eastern thought that kind of led to this. But in today's world, you know, we still see discussions about humanity discovering its true self and figuring out ways for, you know, for us to recover our divinity. And so, you know, all of this stuff is as old as the Garden of Eden, because this is really where we started off, in that the promise of Lucifer was not so much that he was going to give you a meal with, you know, some apples that might taste pretty good, but that, in fact, he was going to allow you to have a seat at the table, to take the food analogy a little too far, and enable you to be sort of at the same level as God himself, that you would be able to discern good and evil. You would be as the gods. And so this is the old lie, and it continues to be packaged. And C.S. Lewis made somewhat of an interesting observation in one of his books where he talks about, you know, pantheism and, He said basically pantheism is always put forth as the newest innovation in religion whenever it comes up. But he says, you know, just because it's, you know, just because the shoe fits doesn't mean it's a new shoe. He said pantheism isn't new. Pantheism is the natural bent of the human mind.
Yes.
You know, basically
very
human
good.
Beings, that's what we think of, you know, in terms of God. Well, all God, we just need to get in touch with ourselves.
Yeah.
And so, so I talk a bit about the fact that in the, as we grow to understand more and more about the nature of the physical world, as we understand more and more about quanta and, you know, what it is that really empowers, you know, causes the universe to stay existent, to continue to exist and so forth. As we understand this more, we understand that it seems to have sort of a spiritual element to it. Now, you know, maybe it's this electromagnetism or whatever, but, you know, the idea that I try to get across in that chapter is that, you know, that is that if we argue there's a split between physics or between the physical and the spiritual, we really don't quite understand, you know, we're not up to date. Our reality has not been revised to the 20th century at least. And we have to understand that there is less of a dualism, if you will, between the physical and the spiritual than there was once before. And that in fact, once we understand that, we can begin to understand how spiritual practices can begin to influence physical factors. You know, how rituals might in fact have an influence upon the spiritual world. What we do in terms of our prayers and so forth might have an influence upon the spiritual world. I make the observation in terms of the UFO, you know, sort of world, that the UFO phenomenon became increasingly prevalent after the time of Jack Parsons and the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov. Number of these science fiction guys used to get together back in the 1940s, and they would talk about science fiction. They talk about H.P. Lovecraft, who had written, he had passed away in the 1920s, but he had written back in the 1910s and early 1920s, and really was the father of science fiction. And Lovecraft's concepts, the cult of Cthulhu, the mountains of, I guess it's called the Mountains of Madness, about the South, about Antarctica, and about discovering civilizations in Antarctica. Man, that reads just like the newspaper. He wrote that 100 years ago, and it's like right now, like things are, you know, bubbling up, you know, it seems in Antarctica. So anyway, when these guys started getting together and started talking, all of a sudden UFOs became very prevalent. And they, just for your edification, when they get together at Jack Parsons' house, all the science fiction guys, they called his house the Parsonage.
Wisecrackers.
Well, just, you know, wise guys.
Yeah.
But it's almost as if their thinking about these things helped to generate more and more UFOs.
Yeah.
You know, notwithstanding the fact that I happen to believe that most UFOs are actually man-made.
Yeah.
They're just not disclosed to us yet, but they were based upon technology that was developed somewhat in World War II and then after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, so I'll leave it there, but the idea is that physical can influence the spiritual and vice versa.
Yes. Yeah. Folks, you can find Doug's resources, his books, articles. There are even PowerPoint presentations that would be very edifying for you to get, study, and share with others. And that's at his website. That is www.faith-happens.com. Faith-happens.com. Doug, there's a lot more we could discuss, obviously, but that's going to have to wait till part two of our conversation about revising reality. Folks may think, wow, you covered most of the book, and the truth is we just scratched the surface. There's a lot more there. Maybe by the time
we
get around, volume two will be out.
Yeah, I hope that we're going to get Volume 2 out this summer, late this summer.
Okay.
We're going to get a lot more into the planets, the sun and the moon. We'll talk about things like why the moon might be artificial. we'll talk about the real nature of the sun. We'll talk about whether intelligent life actually existed before on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about the, what's it called, the Mandela effect.
The
talk
Mandela
about
effect,
right, yeah. Revising reality. How about revising history?
Yes.
We'll talk about those kinds of things, and so we have many subjects. I'm just hoping that there's not going to be a volume three. It's too much work, but volume two is going to be out there. We can get it done. We're still doing a lot of research right now, and compiling our thoughts, and still kind of defending volume one, if you will.
Yes, yeah. So, revising reality, a biblical look at the cosmos. Folks, you need to get a copy of this book. You can go to Doug's website again, faith-happens.com, faith-happens.com. Pick up a copy there.
Mike, I've got to interrupt you. I've got to interrupt you because I've simplified for people how to find me.
Good.
By coming up with an alias, which is Doomsday Doug, doomsdaydoug.com, and
hey.
They can just type that. That'll take them to Faith Happens.
That's it.
So
there you go,
that's
folks.
Doomsdaydoug.com. And you can find my book at all my books at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
There's both ebooks as well as printed books, and the ebook format supported Apple ebook, you know, iBook and Lulu and Barnes and Noble's Nook and all that supported. So all my books are available in e format as well as in printed form.
Yeah, and check him out on Twitter at Doomsday Doug.
Oh, yeah.
He'll respond. He's on there looking. Doug, appreciate the conversation. Thanks for joining me.
It was a lot of fun, Mike. Thanks for having me, and I look forward to being with you again before too long.
Amen. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and of course follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. And listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Mica 68 Productions. You can visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.